From WMUA 91.1 FM in Amherst, Massachusetts, this is Writer's Voice. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
People have done some quite creative things on the island. It isn't just these big wind turbines, and people have put up little micro turbines in their backyard, and people have switched their heating systems. So people have tried to do interesting things.
That's journalist Elizabeth Colbert talking about the renewable energy island. It's in Denmark.
We chose food as the kind of little microcosm to examine because it's so personal. We're all making choices about it every day of our lives. A lot of it is quite toxic these days. We don't know a lot about where our food comes from anymore. It's tied to memory, sensation, relationships, community. There's so much there.
And that's playwright Ellen Beckerman. We talked to her in the second half of the show about the play she co-wrote, Milk and Honey. It opens tonight at the Coe Festival of Performance at Amherst College. And we also play an excerpt from an interview we did with Michael Sanders about his book, Families of the Vine. But first, the Danish island of Samsø is known internationally as the Renewable Energy Island. The residents get most of their power from windmills they cooperatively own. Environmental journalist Elizabeth Colbert went there to see how they made their transition from fossil fuels to renewables. Her article, Island in the Wind, A Danish Community's Victory Over Carbon Emissions, was published in the July 7th issue of The New Yorker. Elizabeth Colbert, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, your piece, The Island in the Wind, is about the island of Samsø in the North Sea, which has managed to go carbon negative. Is that correct?
Yes, they are actually slightly carbon negative. You're right. They produce about 10% more energy than they use in aggregate from renewable carbon-free sources.
And they started just about 10 years ago.
Yeah, it's a pretty remarkable story, which is what drew me all the way over there. They started as a result of a contest that was sponsored by the Danish government, where they asked communities to submit a plan to wean themselves off of fossil fuels. And actually, the people on this island of Samsø were not terribly interested in the contest, but someone drew up a plan for them, an engineer who lived in Jutland, and he submitted it, and the island won. And that sort of set in motion this process, which to this day no one can entirely explain, that the whole island sort of got behind this idea.
No one can entirely explain it. Now, I'm going to ask you more about that process because that is the thing that most drew me to the article. But first, tell us about Samsø. How many people live there? What do they do? And what was their carbon footprint before this transformation began?
Yeah, well, it's an island about the size of Nantucket. It's in an arm of the North Sea called the Kattegat, and it's sort of rolling hills. It's sort of weirdly shaped, glacially shaped island. Quite lovely, rolling hills. It's a farming community, basically. It's a very small community of about, right now, their population is shrinking, actually. They're down to about 4,200 people in the winter, and then they're sort of a tourist destination in the summer, and, Americans wouldn't find the beaches very spectacular, but they're sort of thin, but quite lovely beaches around the island. And most people, farming is still the mainstay. Farming and tourism are really the two mainstays of the local economy. So that is that's who they are.
And what was their carbon footprint before they began down this road of becoming the renewable energy island?
Right. It was in pretty typical Danish carbon footprint. It was around 11,000 tons of CO2 per year. So that, that's a lot, but it's really, to be honest, only about half of what Americans are producing. So it was pretty typical for Denmark.
So now how are they generating their energy right now?
Well, the vast majority of it comes from wind, and they were very well positioned, and presumably that's why they won this contest, to take advantage of wind power. It's a very windy part of the world. As I mentioned in the article, I never saw a flag wave on the island. The flags just stick straight out. horizontally. So there's always a wind blowing, and their windmills generate energy most of the time. They're producing power. So they put up 11 of these large land-based towers. Those are 1 megawatt turbines. And that took care of their own electricity use. So that covered all of the electricity that the people on the island used, these 11 large wind turbines. And then they thought to themselves, okay, well, what are we going to do about transportation, which is generally about half of the energy that we use? And at that point, they were sort of hoping that electric cars would come along and they would be able to use plug-in cars. But that never happened. So they thought about it and said, okay, well, we will offset what we are using for our ferries, for our trucks, for our tractors, and they added all that up, and that was relatively easy to do because, you know, all the oil has to be imported onto the island on tankers or on ferries. So they knew exactly what was coming onto the island, and they added that up and they translated it. You can do a pretty easy energy conversion into kilowatt hours, and they said, okay, how many kilowatt hours do we have to produce to offset that? And they came up with this idea of putting up 10 sea-based turbines, so the sort of turbines that people are talking about putting up with Cape Wind, quite significant turbines, 2.1 megawatts, I think, or maybe 2.3, very tall. And they successfully did that. And the thing that was really amazing about it all is that it is all, almost all of it was with private money. There was with private investors, so people invested in these turbines with the notion that after about 8 years, they would start making money by selling this power from these turbines. And now people are starting to see a small, after several years, some of them are starting to see a small profit. So in addition to, just going carbon neutral, the sort of amazing part about it, as I say, is that they really did it with their own funds, and they're a very small island.
They did it with their own funds. Now, how wealthy are they?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, as they continually pointed out to me, they're farmers. They're making money off of potatoes. They're not wealthy people at all. So many of them had to borrow from the bank to invest in these wind turbines. But, for a combination of reasons, some altruistic and some, sort of very hard-headed, thinking, maybe this is a good investment, people did. So many hundreds of people. This island only has, as I said, like 4,100 people. But several hundred people, 500, 600, 700 people are invested in these turbines, own shares, and then they set up these cooperatives so you could buy, because buying a turbine, we're talking $1 million. So they set up these co-ops where you could buy shares in them.
And we're speaking with Elizabeth Colbert. Her article, The Island in the Wind, A Danish Community's Victory Over Carbon Emissions, appeared in the most recent New Yorker magazine. So they got together, as you said, there was a combination of reasons. There was some altruism on the one hand, and on the other, some good, hard-headed business sense here.
Right.
An idea that they could make some money. But it took a while to get going. They themselves talk about themselves as being conservative farmers. But so say, talk about that process, about how it got going, what had to happen for it to really get underway.
Well, that's a very good question. That's sort of a very interesting, sociology question in a lot of ways. And since a lot of the question of, how are we going to deal with climate change, how are we going to change our energy systems, they're really not technological questions at this point. They're really sociological questions. So that is a very key element here. Now, I don't want to sort of romanticize it, but one thing that was key was there was one guy on the island who really, quite a charismatic guy, who really believed in the project, and he kept pushing it, uphill. It was sort of like pushing a rock uphill, and he knew that, and I spoke to him quite extensively, but he sort of felt like once the project got going, people on the island who rely on each other and know each other and trust each other, once some people got involved, this would prompt other people to get involved. So he really worked on, what we would call opinion leaders to get involved, and then people would come out, the mayor or people like that would say, okay, I'm going to buy a share in one of these, wind turbines. How about you? And so that's sort of how the project snowballed, really. And so at the beginning, people were just waiting for someone else to do something, and the really hard part was getting the first people to move, as he told me. But then once the first people started to move, then other people decided it was sort of a safe thing to do, or maybe a fun thing to do, or maybe you know, just the socially acceptable thing to do. And more people got involved, and more people started to think about energy in creative ways. So people have done some quite creative things on the island. It isn't just these big wind turbines. Some people have put up little micro turbines in their backyard, and people have switched their heating systems. So people have tried to do interesting things.
It sounds to me very much like a case study that would work well with the study of behavioral economics. That's the study of what motivates people to make the economic decisions that they do. I mean, you're talking here about competition and the power of mimicry, social networks. But these folks, how ordinary really are they? I mean, they live simply in a small, tight-knit community where those kinds of things, the social networking, can really work. How translatable is this to cities, states, or even countries?
Well, I think that's, you know, one of the great questions of the hour. I mean, how are we going to change behavior, to change the way people think about things? And I think that they are unusual in that they are an island, in that they all know each other, in that they know exactly what other people are doing. And so in a certain sense, you know, obviously it's not translatable to Boston or New York City, where, you know, there's millions of people who are quite anonymous. On the other hand, we are all influenced by what we see around us. We're all influenced by the mass media. We're all influenced by our friends and our neighbors and, as you say, our social networks. So, you know, on some fundamental level, we are all, you know, very much the same, and they were very, very ordinary people. They are the first to say that they're very ordinary people. They're not, you know, they're not early adapters. They weren't people who were into, you know, sort of high-tech gadgetry or whatever, but they're very handy, too. You know, if you're a farmer, you know how to fix things. You're not really afraid of machinery. So that's part of it, too. You know, many of us would not be able to, you know, hook up a wind turbine in our backyard, but if you're someone who's used to sort of, you know, getting by on your own and fixing your own machinery, you're much more comfortable with that sort of thing.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Elizabeth Colbert about her article in the July 7th issue of The New Yorker magazine. It's called The Island in the Wind. It's about a Danish community that's brought its carbon emissions to less than zero through cooperatively owned wind power and other means. So what does that then say about how, you know, what part of that do you think is translatable? I mean, we produce this show here in the Pioneer Valley of Western Massachusetts, a place where, you know, there are a lot of people doing and thinking things about sustainability. So there is kind of the social capital, let's say, to begin doing this. And the great question we face is, you know, how do we move the political will?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things, lessons that did come out of this, I thought was very interesting, and I've thought a lot about it, you know, as you say, why the Pioneer Valley would be a perfect place for some really, you know, interesting things to be going on. And I'm sure there are interesting things going on. But one thing I think that the lesson of SAMHSA shows us is that you do need people getting together. And there's a real culture in Denmark of these co-ops where people form co-ops and they, you know, elect a board of directors and it's, you know, run, you know, quasi like a business, but everybody owns shares and everybody has an equal voice in it. And they formed several of those. And unless you do that, you can't raise enough capital. So I can put solar panels on my roof, but I can't do a project, you know, that requires a couple $1 million. But if I get, you know, 500 people, 1,000 people together, and we all, chip in $1,000 or $500, then we have capital and we can do some things, more interesting things, more ambitious things. But that is something that's really lacking in the U.S. We don't do things like that. We expect a corporation to come in or an entrepreneur to come in. So I think that is a really interesting lesson for us, that we shouldn't be, you know, just waiting around for someone else to do it.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I spoke recently with the director of a company that develops community-owned wind systems. But it is a model that struggles. It's not just about psychology. There are also laws in this country that reward the big utilities.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, there are the two models. There's the big utility model, and there's the cooperative community model.
Right, right. Well, I think that is a very good point. I think that's a very good point, and I think that, you know, those are those are laws that we need to change as that. But you're right, there are a lot of things working, forces working against it.
So then that goes back to the idea of political will. You know, some people, who was it, Eisenhower said, you know, it takes the push from the people. Now here I'm totally paraphrasing because I don't remember the quote at all. But, you know, it takes the people to push the leaders rather than the other way around. How do you see what's happening? You've been covering this beat for a long time. What do you see in terms of the movement on the kind of actual concrete political will to do these kinds of things as you've been doing that? And I guess maybe I'm talking about this country.
Well, I mean, that's the question of the hour, and I am at once heartened by a lot of things that are going on and a lot of clearly people feeling a lot of pressure to at least say that they're acting. But I think that the, you know, from people, from their constituents, but I think that the problem is that people are kind of in their own minds, you know, not quite clear about the scale of the problem, what needs to be done, what they're willing to accept in the service of getting it done. So at the same time that people say they want action on global warming, they also say, you know, bring down the price of gasoline. Well, you know, the fact is that those are incompatible goals. The price of all forms of carbon-based energy really need to go up in order for us to make meaningful progress and sort of what people would say level the playing field between, you know, oil and coal and renewable forms of energy. So I think that, you know, politicians, if they were in a frank moment of frankness, would say, you know, we're feeling sort of these two contradictory forces coming up from our constituents. And the question is, you know, sort of which will win out. And I can't say I'm terribly heartened. And I think that the other problem is, unfortunately, when people, you know, it's pretty easy on an issue like global warming to set these long-term lofty goals like we just saw come out of the G8. But in the meantime, nothing gets done, and in fact, exactly the opposite of what needs to get done is happening. So I can't say that I've really seen enough of a demand from the public that something really meaningful happen.
You just mentioned the G8, and the G8 has just decided to have a non-binding, that is, unenforceable resolution to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 50% by 2050. Now that's instead of the 80% by 2020 that is becoming the new scientific consensus.
Well, 80% by 2020 is, you know, I do want to say that I have to throw my, you know, lot in with the people who say that's just impractical. I mean, 80%, imagine your life with 80% less CO2 in the next 12 years. That's really, 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 I mean, it could be done, but Lord knows it would be truly miraculous. But an 80% by 2050, that is certainly doable, and that should be our goal. But, you know, 80%, 50%, the fact of the matter is we are going in the wrong direction. You know, we should not be arguing about whether we're cutting things 80% or 50%, you know, 42 years from now. We should say, okay, and this is what people really faulted this G8 agreement for. We should have a clear goal by 2020. Okay, maybe it's not 80%, maybe it's 20%, maybe it's 10%. We need to just, the first step is to get carbon emissions to stop growing and to start shrinking, and we are not doing that. So I don't think, my own view is we should not, you know, sit here wrangling over some long-term goal, what we're going to be doing 2050. We should set very clear targets and goals, and we need the policies to get us there. Once again, these goals are meaningless without some policies that are going to, you know, that you have a pretty good chance of getting there. And those are what are the real sticking point. The goals, you know, are just, you know, to a certain extent, a certain amount of BS, to be frank.
Well, point well taken. And I did say the new scientific consensus, not the new political consensus.
Right, yes. No, look, the scientific consensus, you know, there's a growing scientific consensus around the fact that we need to completely stop CO2 emissions, and we need to actually reduce the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere. We, and in order to do that, you need to, you know, plant trees and, I mean, all sorts of things to actually take CO2 out of the air. But, you know, there does come a point where you, unfortunately, you have these two realities, and one is the scientific reality and one is the political reality, and they are colliding. They are absolutely in collision, and they're in a potentially quite devastating collision.
We're talking with New Yorker journalist Elizabeth Colbert. She wrote the recent article published in The New Yorker, An Island in the Wind, A Danish Community's Victory Over Carbon Emissions. And that is really what the importance, I think, of your article is all about, because it talks about doing this on a realistic basis, not just using people's altruism, but their self-interest. When we talk about what is actually doable, you talk about a project called the 2000-Watt Society, which was thought up in Switzerland. Tell us about that.
Well, that's a really, on some level, much more ambitious project even than the Renewable Energy Island. That is a bunch of scientists who got together and said, okay, let's be honest about this. What does sustainability mean? You know, people throw that around, but what does it mean? What kind of energy level of energy use is genuinely sustainable? And they came up with this idea of 2,000 watts. And what does 2,000 watts mean? We don't really think in watts. We get our electric bills in kilowatt hours. So 2,000 watts is the equivalent of if you were using 2,000 watts continuously, and that turns out to be roughly 17,500 kilowatt hours per person, now per year. And most of the world uses less than 2,000 watts. You know, if you live in China or Bangladesh or India, you're using less than 2,000 watts on average. And if you live in the U.S., you're using 12,000 watts. So for the developed world, it means very radical energy reductions. And for the developing world, it's sort of a ceiling on what each individual should be using as their energy usage grows very, very rapidly. So this is their, you know, it's sort of a thought experiment. Obviously, on some level, it doesn't exist, but there are a lot of projects actually in Switzerland that are aimed at demonstrating that this is, in fact, feasible. Some very ultra-efficient buildings that are very close to what we'd call net-zero buildings using generating almost as much energy as they actually use. They're very tightly insulated. They're very interesting buildings. I went to visit a lot of them, and as they point out, you know, this is not hardship. This is being much, much smarter about how we use energy. And we have really, you know, resisted that wonderful phrase of Dick Cheney's that, you know, conservation is a personal virtue. Well, it is not just a personal virtue. At this point, it is, you know, an absolute necessity.
You say that this is not a hard existence. This doesn't mean going back to the Stone Age. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, as they pointed out to me, you know, Switzerland, now this is not true of the U.S. because we're a lot more spread out, but Switzerland was a 2,000-watt society, so people used 2,000 watts around 1960. And life was different. I mean, I don't think anyone would argue that life wasn't different, but as people pointed out, we lived a very nice life in Switzerland in 1960. So it's not a radical thought. Right now, Switzerland is operating at about 5,000 watts. So it means cutting, you know, your fossil fuel use by more than half. And it's not easy. And one of the, you know, themes that comes through the piece is, you know, you can't constantly be jetting around the world. You use up, you know, 2,000 watts basically in one long plane flight. So there would be things, you know, life would be different. But that doesn't mean that life would be, you know, dreadful. It doesn't mean that we would all be living in hovels. It means that, you know, certain things would be, you'd be less likely to do, and certain things you'd be more likely to do.
In fact, you say, I believe it, you say that people are actually happier living at a lower energy use level. And we should point out that even though we have more energy using gadgets, we also have much higher efficiencies in 1960.
Yes, absolutely. And I should point out, I don't know if people are happier using less energy. I don't think we know that yet. But I think that, you know, one thing that has happened recently, and where something like this might have seemed, you know, just absolutely absurd with oil prices low, when oil prices start to rise, I think it reminds people of something that, you know, on some level they've always known, which is that you can't keep using finite resources as if they were not finite. So we're up against, you know, two major, really, really major problems, one of which is climate change, And the other of which is that, you know, we're actually running out of some of these resources that we've used so profligately. So we are not going to be able to keep living the way we did. That's just clear at this point. We have, you know, sort of used up all, as James Hansen has said, we have used up all the slack in the system. And we are going to have to make some changes. And the question that is before us right now is, are we going to make those changes, you know, wisely and intelligently and in ways that mean a pretty peaceful and orderly and reasonable transition, or are we just going to wait, you know, for some kind of catastrophe? And that's a question that I can't answer at this point.
And, of course, that catastrophe will be incredibly expensive, much more expensive than dealing with a problem. But still, people do ask about how much is this going to cost and how much is it going to cost me in taxes? I don't know if you can answer the second question, but you do talk a little bit in the article, The Island in the Wind, the article in The New Yorker, about the cost. You say it's not going to be all that much.
Well, people who have looked at this issue, you know, very, very seriously, have looked at what it would take to, you know, a transition to a low-carbon economy. And, you know, a figure that's sort of widely used, and maybe a little bit low, but anyway, is around 1% of the global economy. If you invested 1% of the global economy, you could make this transition, you know, relatively painlessly. And that, you know, you have to say by definition 1%, you know, is doable. I mean, it means we have 99% left to do, you know, other things. And we are right now spending roughly, now that oil prices have shot up, we are spending 7% of global GDP on oil. So, you know, clearly 1% is doable, but it means, you know, shifting your priorities very, very dramatically, and there will be some groups that will, you know, be losers, to be frank, some parts of these sectors of the economy, and many others that will be winners. And we are very bad at that. We cling to the status quo. You know, there's a term in behavioral economics, you know, status quo bias. We are just very status quo biased. We will always stick to the status quo if we can. And that is what we are trying to do. We're desperately trying to prop up the status quo, even though we know that's really not what we should be doing.
And it sounds like it's going to take the pain to prod us towards the pleasure of changing it to a safer and more renewable society.
Right, and I think the question, and the real question, and it's just no one can answer it at this point, is, you know, whether we will do that, you know, before we have set in motion, you know, climate change of a really, really catastrophic variety, and that's a, you know, that's both a social question and a scientific question, and then it won't be answered, you know, for a few decades. But I fear it won't be answered very well.
You know, as you talk, I hear in you what I struggle with all the time, and that is the sense of impending catastrophe. You know, just the sense that human nature is just not going to make the right decisions, or whatever it may be, human nature, social structure.
Right.
How do you deal with this? You wrote an article a year or so ago about the bees,
mm-hmm.
And the collapse, colony collapse disorder,
mm-hmm.
among bees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you own bees yourself. I mean, this is a very personal issue for you as a journalist, as a person, as it is for so many of us. How do you deal with the sense of despair that must be there, that note that I hear in your voice?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I'm not a, you know, I'm not a psychologist, really. I think that the only thing that I can say is that I'm sure that this comes through in much of what I've written. I am not at all, you know, optimistic about our capacity to rise to this challenge. Now, that being said, I think that we all have the obligation, you know, to act as if there is still that opportunity, because, you know, what are the alternatives? You know, it's true in just about any aspect of your life. You know, the alternative is giving up, and, you know, giving up is always an option, but it's not really a very productive one. So I think that we all really need to do what we can. I mean, it's a very simple, you know, not very sophisticated point, but I guess that is how I look at things, while at the same time not at all being, you know, I'm not at all one of these people who says, you know, everything is going to be all right in the end. I think that's, you know, if you look at the facts and you just look at the numbers and you just look at what we've done so far, that's not the conclusion that you come to.
Yes, although if we do follow the example of Samsø in the North Sea, the Danish island that has become the renewable energy island, then we've got a fighting chance.
Yes, absolutely, and I think we have the obligation to try. I mean, I think that is what people sort of often gloss over. You know, you have to try things, even if you have no guarantee of their success, especially, you know, when the stakes are so high.
Well, Elizabeth Colbert, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And you can find a link to Colbert's article at writersvoice.net. Colbert is also the author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, a frontline report on climate change. Next up, playwright Ellen Beckerman. Stay tuned. This program is made possible in part by an underwriting grant from Meeting House Books in South Deerfield, a secondhand bookshop with 35,000 books in a wide variety of areas, including literature, history, fine arts, and performing arts, as well as a growing collection of antique prints. Book lovers of every description are welcome to browse at Meeting House Books, which can be reached by phone at 413-665-0500 or online at www.meetinghousebooks.com. WMUA thanks Meeting House Books for their kind support. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The theme of this year's Co-Festival of Performance at Amherst College is food. One of the plays featured is Milk and Honey, a play about the pleasures and politics of eating. Blending fact and fiction, it's based on interviews the company did with workers in food and agriculture, diabetics, dumpster divers, people with eating disorders, politicians, and others. After the play, the audience is treated to a banquet of locally grown foods. I spoke with Ellen Beckerman from her home in New York earlier this month. Ellen Beckerman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
And tell us a little bit about yourself. You're the artistic director of Lightbox.
Yes.
What is that?
Lightbox is a group of about 11 artists, directors, actors, designers, theater artists, I should say. We're a nonprofit theater company. We started about 8 years ago, and we do very, very physical work. All our plays are really physical, very kinetic. And we started doing adaptations of classic plays with kind of a punk rocky edge. And lately we've been creating plays from scratch as a company.
You've been, and this most recent play, Milk and Honey, tell us a little bit about it. This is a play about food and why we eat what we eat.
Right.
Why a play about food?
We like to think it's a play that's really about democracy and choice making, and what information is available to us these days. In all aspects of our life, food is an easy thing to kind of focus on, but it's really about getting shut out of a system or how we choose to participate and when are we shut out of participating in politics, in economics, in social life, in healthcare, in every aspect of our lives. And we just chose food as the kind of little microcosm to examine because it's so personal. We're all making choices about it every day of our lives. A lot of it is quite toxic these days. We don't know a lot about where our food comes from anymore. It's tied to memory, sensation, relationships, community. There's so much there.
And so how do you relate it to democracy?
Well, it's partly in the text that we choose that goes into the play itself. I mean, democracy was always front and center on our minds as we researched and wrote the play. And the play is based on interviews, I should say. So what we did was we went out and interviewed people from all over the country who have interesting relationships with food. So we talked to migrant farm workers and advertising executives and people with eating disorders and people with diabetes and farmers and chefs and waiters and anyone and everyone we could talk to who have relationships with food. But we also did lots of research about America. What does it mean to be an American? Consumerism came up a lot. This idea of the American dream, is that really to have things, or are there other aspects of the American dream? What makes us happy as a people? Our right to participate? When are we not participating? And we chose certain texts that are not directly about food, but reflect that bigger idea of, or bigger question of, what is it to be an American these days?
So give us an example of that. Say something about how the American dream relates to food.
Well, for example, one of the main characters in the play is a man named Jesus, who is a recent immigrant from Mexico, and we show him, he's come to the United States to pick tomatoes, basically as a migrant farm worker. So, to introduce his main scene in the play, we have text that is not about food, but is taken directly from a verbal exam given to new citizens. And some of the, they're not really questions, but like the proctor will give a statement, and then the people taking the exam must repeat that statement in good English. And the statements are things like, I want a new TV. I don't have time to talk today. My wife looks at the cars as they pass through the window. Things that we thought were odd to put on an exam and seem to be trying to indoctrinate the new citizens into a certain kind of materialistic and also lonely existence that they would have in the United States. So we have that text being said by all the actors on stage, and then the next scene is we see Jesus on his first day in the field picking tomatoes and what happens to him on that day. So we're trying to put ideas about America and what it is to be a citizen in this country up against scenes that are more directly related with food and let those ideas just bounce off each other. And really, the audience is connecting all those dots for themselves.
And of course, so many of those immigrants are in fact harvesting our food.
Yeah, and kids, yeah, that's exactly right. They are. Them and their children.
You mentioned the word loneliness, and it strikes me that in many ways Americans have a very lonely relationship to their food, something that is so totally different and counter to the way through most of human history we've related to food, which has always been a kind of congenial thing.
Yeah, I mean, I was just watching a TV ad yesterday where the main asset of this particular food item was that you can eat it on the run, and I was just thinking, that's absurd, and in most countries that would not be considered a bonus, because you do have the long, leisurely lunch, and I think that also goes hand in hand with satisfaction, like the ability to sit at a table and really enjoy the food you're eating and the company you're with is not really a part of the food tradition in this country. It's much more eat on the run, eat when you can, and eat alone rather than as a group.
Well, I also noticed, at least when you perform this play in New York, you would follow it up with a kind of an after-play cafe.
Yeah.
Is that related somehow to this idea of congeniality?
I mean, definitely. The whole point of this experience, Milk and Honey and the cafe, which really go hand in hand and are inseparable, is to bring people together in a space where they can talk, make decisions, take action, brainstorm, and enjoy each other's company with food as the centerpiece.
And are you having an after-play cafe also at the CoFest and at Amherst College?
Definitely, yeah. I don't have the schedule in front of me, but every day after each performance, there will be a different partner organization, sometimes more than one partner organization, joining us in the cafe for coffee and treats and discussions.
That sounds delicious.
It's a lot of fun. It's great.
Talk a little bit more about how you did these interviews. This is part fiction, part documentary. I read in the description of the play, but you based it in part on interviews. You mentioned a little bit about who you talked to. Tell us again, where did you go for these interviews, and who were, you know, maybe give us some examples of some of the people that most stand out for you.
Sure. Well, there were about five of us who were core writers on the project, and we were going to write it together. And we knew that the first thing we wanted to do was get as many opinions and points of view and stories as possible. So each of us followed our own interest. We each took a couple of subjects that we were personally fascinated by and just started hunting down people. So we started locally. For example, I was interested in diabetes, so I just started calling some local hospitals. And had some help, like company members would help me do that. And you start asking your friends, and eventually people start volunteering, and you sit down with them for, you know, half an hour and an hour, and the stories start flowing. And other people, one of our actors was interested in farming, family farming, and happened to also be doing a play in Wisconsin, and went out to a family farm or two out there and walked around the farm and interviewed the farmers. We also were interested in flavor chemistry, So our sound designer went out to New Jersey to a couple of flavor chemistry firms and spent many, 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 many hours with them. They were really generous out there and took him through the lab and through the whole chemical process of creating new smells and tastes. And we were very interested in migrant workers, and so we went and interviewed some people. And it just so happened that one of our video designers was living in Mexico but was from New York. So while they were in Mexico, she had the opportunity to talk to people there who had relatives in New York, and then they were able to come back to New York and talk to some people up here as well. And just in our daily travels, I mean, we got to talk to people in California, Chicago, South Dakota, Arizona, all over the country. Some of those happened on the phone, and some happened in person.
We're talking with Ellen Beckerman about food. She's a director and co-playwright of Milk and Honey, a play featured at this year's CoFest, a drama festival at Amherst College. Well, you did the interviews and based some of the play on them, but there's also a fictional storyline. Tell us a little bit about that.
The fictional storyline, well, every storyline has a little bit of fiction in it. A lot of the storylines are composites of several people that we interviewed. But there's a fictional storyline that has to do with a dumpster diver and a grocery store clerk who fall in love. And they both work inside the grocery store, and this kind of romance starts heating up. And the stock boy named Ambrose takes the grocery store clerk out behind the back alley of the grocery store to show her something special, and it turns out that he's a dumpster diver or a freegan, which is basically someone that lives off what the rest of us throw away. So this is very, very popular in New York City. There are lots of groups that go out and basically get great food items out of the trash that grocery stores throw away at the end of the day or at the end of the week.
And say that word again. What is it called?
Freegan, like F-R-E-E-G-A-N, like vegan, but basically not paying for food, I guess.
And it's you can get pretty good food in New York that way, can't you?
Yeah, you really can. It's a little bit shocking. There's like hundreds of thousands of pounds of perfectly edible food that gets thrown out every day.
And have you ever done that?
I have not, but several members of the company have.
Uh-huh. And okay, so you got a love interest here.
Yeah.
And you have a number of different storylines that weave in and out as well. Is that right?
That's right. So we chose five main characters, and then we also have a chorus of secondary characters who give little monologues. So we're hitting maybe about 20 different characters in the play. I actually haven't counted, but I think it's about that.
Now, you mentioned before that you wrote it collaboratively with several other people. There's Madeline George, Bray Poor, C. Andrew Bauer, Sean Fagan, and yourself. Talk about this collaborative process. Was that difficult? Was it exciting? What was it like?
It was very, very exciting and very, very difficult. I mean, some of the difficulty was just logistical difficulty. We were not all in the same place at the same time. So we wrote a lot of it separately and then would connect through the internet or on phone calls and give each other feedback. Part of the challenge was that, with the exception of Madeline, who's an extremely brilliant writer, none of us had really written many plays before, certainly. So we were kind of new at it and definitely pushing ourselves to do something that was a little bit scary but certainly exciting.
But you have a background, I mean, you have a history in theater.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. But writing, you know, writing is very difficult. I mean, I've always found it very exciting and easy to create new work with an ensemble, but that doesn't mean you're necessarily sitting down and trying to put words in characters' mouths. And we have a lot of experience with found text, but this was really taking real people in the world who we had met and who we really care about and are trying to be true to and turning them into somewhat fictional characters. So that was quite challenging, and we always would remind ourselves, we want to assume that every person who appears in the play will be sitting in the front row of the audience. And that was kind of our guide. Like, if we would feel good if they were sitting in the front row of the audience, then we knew we were on the right track in terms of representing them.
And have any of them been sitting in the front row of the audience?
Yes, a few have. I mean, I wish I could say they all had been there, but a few have, and they were very, very supportive.
So who did come?
I believe that some of the flavor chemists came and some of the diabetics came. I mean, we talked to so many people that there's not like a one-to-one relationship between the interviewee and the character. We did not have migrant workers. They're a much more difficult group of people to get into a theater. We really tried, and it didn't work, but we have hopes for the future.
And why were you interested in diabetes?
Well, it's one of America's greatest exports right now. They find that all over the world, as people are eating more American-made junk food, the diabetes rates all over the world are just skyrocketing. And it's a huge problem in New York City. And so we really felt like we couldn't address what's happening with food in this country without addressing diabetes.
You know, it's interesting that this whole festival, this year, the CoFest, is about food. The play, as you're talking about it, is about democracy and community and health. What about cost? You know, now we're in a time when food prices are skyrocketing.
Yeah.
Is this something that just kind of came up without you seeing it and smacked you in the head, or were you able to incorporate it into this play?
You know, the way that we deal with it in the play is, you know, we wrote the play last year, so the way we deal with it in the play is Renee, one of the main characters who's dealing with diabetes, lives in a food desert, which is an area, usually urban, where there are a lot of liquor stores and fast food joints, but not a lot of access to fresh, healthy, affordable food. And we have a scene in the play where she is trying to make healthier food because she's trying to deal with her diabetes. She can't find any healthy food in her neighborhood. She ends up traveling quite a distance to get that healthy food, and she pays a lot for it. And there's a big argument that ensues in her household when her family starts figuring out how much she paid for the meal. Since we wrote that a year ago, prices have skyrocketed, and that's really much more top priority. And so we haven't addressed it explicitly except for in that one scene, really.
And in fact, I understand the prices of fruits and vegetables, which of course should be the basis of a healthy diet, at least, you know, are even more expensive. I mean, we hear about corn and wheat going up, which is true.
Yeah.
But it's those other healthy foods that are even higher, if possible.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
And finally, what about our obsession with food? Do you get into any of that?
Well, we have some sweet tooths in the play who are certainly obsessed with sweet, gooey foods that remind them of great times during their childhood. And I think as a whole, we address the kind of national eating disorder that we have, which comes partly from just not having stable food traditions, I think, which leaves us susceptible to the latest fad. I mean, I remember when I was in college, oat bran was the huge thing, and everyone was just shoving oat bran down their throats. And then a couple of years later, they said, oh, yeah, we thought it was really healthy, but it turns out to be insignificant. And then it was on to the next fad, and there have been, you know, hundreds since then. There's this great writer, Frederick Kaufman, who writes for Harper's, and he writes about food, and he has really pinpointed this national eating disorder as something that comes from the Puritans, actually. He connects it to the early Puritan eating, binging and purging rituals.
Well, you know, I remember that oat bran fad, and I'm so glad. It seems to me that it at least in my life, it's been replaced by the dark chocolate fad.
Yeah, my mom is very happy about that, too.
Well, Ellen Beckerman, we look forward very much to, I look forward to seeing your play, and I hope that many of our listeners will also. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure.
Milk and Honey opens at the festival today, Friday, July 18th. You can find a link for more information about the festival at writersvoice.net or go to cofest.com. And finally, wine growers in the south of France. How they remind us of the value of agriculture on the small, local scale. We've just enough time on today's show to bring you an excerpt from an interview I did in 2005 with Michael Sanders. His book is Families of the Vine, Seasons Among the Winemakers of Southwest France. It's the second book he's written about the small villages of that region.
When you live in a place that is this small, you tend to notice the things that are very important, and wine is the economy of this region of France. So it is a normal thing, for example, in the fall, in late September or early October to go into a cafe and see everybody covered in purple because they've been picking grapes. It's just part of the landscape.
Well, tell us a little bit about this region. First of all, this is in the region of the Lot, is that
the Lot.
Tell us where it is, and it's also a very specific part of that region.
Well, this is the least populated and one of the poorest provinces in France. It's never been developed industrially. It has very poor infrastructure. And as a result, it kind of was this neglected island that was known for a few things. One of them is the black truffle, sometimes called the truffle of Périgord, which is one of the northern cities in this province. It's a region that's known for ducks and foie gras, and also for Vendico, or the wine that I wrote about. It is a place where life really still runs at a country rhythm, and there are a lot of farmers who still are really not that far removed from subsistence farming. They grow a little tobacco, they grow a little corn for their own animals, and to feed up ducks that they will raise for foie gras. Not a hugely busy place.
It sounds very much like where I lived for 8 months in France, which was in Haute-Provence, which also has a different, there it's lavender, I think, rather than wine, although mm-hmm. there is certainly olive production, and there is wine production there. Very remote, relatively poor, one of the least populated places on the planet, according to some people there. One of the things that really I learned so much there was the ways in which people still hold on to the old traditions, and that seems to be very much also a theme in your book.
Well, that's sort of the theme of my entire career in writing. I'm very, very interested in tradition and modernity and that clash, and sometimes when I hear economists babbling on about globalization, It just makes me very angry because in a place probably in your village, as in the village where I lived, globalization it's right there in front of your face. It's on a very small scale, but you see people who are really scratching out a living, and everything that they've done over time has come to naught. They're working out a living from these niches, whether it's wine, whether it's foie gras, whether it's black truffles, and that's one of the things that impressed me most, was how they have this ability to keep the good in the tradition and to really value it and to understand its value and to stop and ask those hard questions before they say, we're going to change, we're going to do something differently. There's an adaptation there that I found absolutely fascinating. And I'll give you an example of this. In winemaking, the huge popular thing of the moment is wines that are organic or almost organic. And a good French winemaker making Appellation wine, that's the highest level of wine, these folks, they laugh because they have been making almost organic wine for hundreds of years. They never used chemical fertilizers. They never irrigated their vines. The whole culture that they grew up in was about making good wine, and you cannot make good wines if you do not treat your vines in the absolute most positive, healthy way. When you start adding things to the soil, the only fertilizer that they use in that whole region is composted cow manure. That's it. Their whole culture is about keeping close to the land, because if they don't, they have crappy grapes and they make crappy wine. It's very simple to them. So to them, an adaptation to the modern world is to say, we don't need to have satellite images, that infrared images that tell us when our grapes are ripe. You know, why do we have to pay the government to do these surveys and then send us this information? We're in our vines every single day. We know what's ripe. We know exactly what's ripe, when to pick it, and then what to do with it afterwards. I think that's one of the things that impresses me, just how they manage to hold on to what is good, to realize that it's good, and to really stop before they pave paradise.
You talk about three different families in this vine-growing region of the Cahors. Is that how you pronounce it?
Cahors, exactly right.
Each one takes a bit of a different approach, even in terms of what you've just been talking about, in terms of how they relate to that global market. I wonder if you could kind of sketch out what those three different approaches are briefly.
Sure. Well, I picked these families because, First of all, they've all been on the same land, the oldest since 1640, and the one that's been there the least for 160 years. So they've been around for a while, so they know what they're doing. Their fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers and great-grandmothers were all involved in wine and vines. The second was these three families, the Jouffreaux, the Baldes, and the Bernedes, have very different approaches. Bernard Philippe is a man of the modern world, and he will try things that are new. The way he's the most modern is his approach to marketing his wine. He will go anywhere to market it. He's very successful. In fact, his wine, which is called Clos la Coutale, you can find almost across the entire United States, and that is not true of the other two wines. He is a man whose land and vines actually lend themselves to a wine that is a little softer, a little fruitier, and therefore, in wine speak, easier to drink. Then on the other extreme, we have even Martine Jouffreau, and they don't even use oak in their wine. They do not put their oak in wine barrels. They consider that it's not necessary for their particular kinds of grapes. All these families use Malbec grapes, and Malbec is a grape that lends itself to what are called vin de garde, which are wines that you lay down. You don't make them and then drink them the next spring like Nouveau Beaujolais. They really need 5, sometimes even 10 years in particular vintages before they reach their peak. They're not wines that need that edge that oak gives them. Then in the middle, you have Jean-Luc Baldes at Clos Trigadina, and this fellow is doing a lot of really interesting things. It actually gets back to the theme I was just talking about how you sort of adapt tradition. He's working with wines that he and his father started making, but also he has resurrected 2 old traditional wines and brought them back to the market. In history, this region, Cahors, which is about an hour and a half south of Bordeaux and about an hour and a half north of Toulouse, it's a region that has been making wine for 2,000 years. It has a reputation, really a reputation that's almost 1,000 years old, amongst the British particularly, for making wines that are very dark, black. In fact, the Brits called it the black wine. And even in the 1500s, for example, when English people were drinking wine, they were not drinking Bordeaux. They were drinking wines from this region. So what he did was he looked back and asked how they made this wine, what was special about it, rediscovered this process, which was taking a certain portion of the grapes and putting them in an oven on wooden trays and evaporating, in a sense, a little bit of their juice and then adding that back to the fermentation tank. The wine you get is a really plummier, really rich, intense wine that's, in fact, excellent to drink with the food of the region, with duck, with foie gras, with cassoulet, with those sort of more peasanty kinds of dishes. So here's the range. You have a modern fellow who's running around the globe who's making a wine that's, in a sense, a little more for an international audience. You have the absolute traditionalists who won't even put their wine in oak. And then the guy in the middle who is trying a lot of different things in the local idiom to make it.
Michael Sanders. He's also the author of From Here You Can't See Paris, and he's working on a new book about Armagnac, the liqueur. We'll be sure to get him on the show when he comes out with that one. Well, that's it this week for Writer's Voice. Please join us next week when we talk with Jill Bolte Taylor. Her memoir is My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey. To find out more about Writer's Voice and upcoming guests, visit our website at writersvoice.net. And you can get our podcast there, too. Please send your thoughts, comments, and questions to writersvoice@wmua.org. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.